Well, ladies and gentlemen, we are in Habakkuk chapter 3, looking at some kind of a theophany. The Lord is appearing. I think I'm going to be safe to say what we're looking at is the end times. We're looking at the second coming, potentially, especially since Habakkuk chapter 2, he says, write down the revelation and make it plain on tablets so that a herald may run with it. For the revelation awaits at a point in time. It speaks of the end. And in Habakkuk's day, right around 606, 608, something like that, let's just say 606 BC, it's before the arrival of Babylon, the decline of Assyria, God is going to send his judgment to Jerusalem. And Habakkuk is concerned. You know, it's like, why are you going to do this? And God, he says, especially with the Babylonians, he says, well, the Babylonians are going to be a tool that's going to judge Jerusalem, but the Babylonians themselves are arrogant, like we talked last night about the seven empires, Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia. It's their turn to inherit the cup of God's judgment that they'll bring on the Assyrians, but also bring on Jerusalem in 605, ultimately 586. And then Babylon is going to cycle through history, and someone else is going to take out the Babylonians, which we will know historically as the Persians. And that's just going to continue because of their arrogance. God is using, and he often does, uses the arrogance, the wickedness of sinful man to bring about his plan. Here, he used Babylonians. For example, he used Judas. He didn't cause Judas to do what Judas did, but Judas was going to be used by God. Judas was going to do this thing. God was going to just go ahead and use it. And so he's using, in a sense, evil, or he's using Satan and Babylon, Persia. All these empires are backed up by Satan. And this is going to cycle throughout. God is coming through the Babylonians, coming through the Persians, coming through the Romans. But ultimately, he's going to come at the end. And this vision that Habakkuk is given, I mean, this is going to take place, but it speaks ultimately of the end. You're not going to see what you desire ultimately until the end of time, after this is cycled all the way through, and the Lord is going to come and intervene. He's not going to use the Babylonians or the Persians. He's going to use his own appearing and is going to set up his own kingdom. And so what I think we're looking at here in chapter 3 is Habakkuk. It's a prayer. It's set to a song. It's going to be sung and rehearsed in the temple by the people of God. But it captures the essence of the message that Habakkuk received. And he's looking forward to the day when this event takes place. He's not looking forward to the destruction of Jerusalem. He's not looking forward to the fall of Babylon, although they're waiting for it. That just means the Persians are going to come. And when the Persians are defeated, it's going to be the Greeks. And then after the Greeks, it's going to be the Romans. Just one empire after another. What they're looking for ultimately, what we're looking for ultimately, is this day that the Lord stops the madness of history, intervenes, and sets up his kingdom. I mean, all the prophets talk about it. And so, this is Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 1. We read this last week. A prayer, I'm reading the NIV right now. A prayer of Habakkuk, the prophet, on Siganith. And that would be a style of music, of some musical genre. Lord, I have heard of your fame. I stand in awe of your deeds. O Lord, renew them in our day, in our time, make them known. In wrath, remember mercy. That's the NIV. And if you remember, that was, he says, I've heard your report. Not just like the NIV says, I've heard of your fame. Habakkuk is saying, I've heard your report, or I've heard your answer. I've heard what you said. I stand in awe of your works, or I'm fearing your works. And the work that he's fearing, if we leave it in context, he's fearing the destruction of Jerusalem. I have heard your report, I hear your plan, and I fear the works that your word has revealed. Renew them in our day, and that refers to bringing life in this time period when Jerusalem is going to, during this cycling, the renewing is bring life. During this time of renewing, or this time of cycling through history, renew this. It's almost like saying, that throughout history, what's taking place in history? It's salvation. God is working salvation through history. Why does history just keep rolling on and we keep going through these empires? Because God is renewing. God is reviving. God is bringing the new birth. Like Peter says, God's patience is the longer God waits, the more people are going to be saved. I'm trying to think God's patience means salvation. And so as he's waiting through this, surely God wants to end this more than we want to end it. But as this goes on, things are being renewed. Things are being prepared for the kingdom of God. And so I stand in awe of your deeds. I fear your works that you're going to do, that you've revealed. But bring light during this time. In our time, make them known. And what that is saying, in our time, during this time here, make them known. Reveal your plan to us. Just like what we're doing tonight. I mean, that's what we are doing tonight. We are having, this is what is taking place. Why are we waiting? God's bringing salvation. God is renewing things. He's in control. I mean, if you see the fall of the United States, if you see our country, it's like, it's in this plan. It is not out of control. It's not what we want. We stand in awe. We stand in fear. But we understand God is working. So keep bringing life to us. Keep revealing your plan. We need to see this in our time. Make them known. In our time, reveal this so we have confidence that we can have faith. And then he says, in wrath, remember mercy. Because obviously we are members of the human race. We can always point at, well, the world's wicked. But all you got to do is look in the mirror and realize, hey, I'm from the world. I am one of these people God has rescued. I'm one of these people that God has renewed during this cycle. I mean, we could just as well think of relatives you've had or have, or think of friends you have. Think of historical people that have gone through this cycle right along with you, and they're just being wiped out. We have been renewed during this cycle. Life has been brought to us. And so during this time, as we're heading towards wrath, remember mercy. And that is, in a sense, that is his prayer that he's praying there at the beginning in verse 2. Then he begins in verse 3 talking about a theophany. And we talked about this last time, well, 2 weeks ago, referring from God coming from Sinai. Different times where God has appeared in history. And it seems like he comes from the south. He comes from the south to help Deborah and Barak. He comes from the south leading Moses and Israel. It says right here in verse 3, God came from Teman, the Holy One, from Mount Paran. That's down south in Edom, down south by Mount Sinai. His glory covered the heavens, and his praise filled the earth. So there's this coming into the heavens, of God appearing in the heavens, and then he's coming to the earth. Like he appeared and came down on Mount Sinai. It's a theophany. And I don't think, like I said several times, he is not just, I do not think Habakkuk is just recounting Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai was an example. It was typical of the Lord appearing in history, appearing in this cycle, just a theophany, and things take place. But it happens several times. It's going to happen. That is exactly what this is going to look like. This is going to be the ultimate, the second coming, the ultimate theophany. And that's what he's looking forward to. His glory covered the heavens, and his praise filled the earth. His splendor was like the sunrise. Rays flashed from his hands, beams shot from his hands, where his power was hidden. That's all they could see was the light, but there's power behind it. Plague went before him, and pestilence followed his steps. Again, the image there is there's attendants going before him and attendants coming behind him, but it's causing a devastating effect on the earth. He is bringing his presence to the earth, and it's going to leave an effect on this fallen earth. He stood and shook the earth. He looked and made the nations tremble. He's there. He's present. And now things are being moved around. Things are being realigned. And this is going to come up again. When God intervenes in history, if it's at Mount Sinai or if it's through Babylon or through Persia, he is realigning the boundaries. He's realigning the nations. He's realigning the power. Some are being judged. Some are being repositioned. And salvation is coming to some sense. Whenever judgment comes, the day of the Lord, there's always going to be salvation coming along with it for his people. He stood and shook the earth. He looked and made the nations tremble. The ancient mountains crumbled. The age-old hills collapsed. His ways are eternal. Right there, we're going to get picking up a theme here that's going to come up again in our verses tonight. Is there are things that are temporal. They've been here, it seems like, forever. This is the way things are. But when he shows up with these eternal ways, our temporal ways that seem like they never change are going to crumble. The ancient mountains crumbled. The age-old hills collapsed. But his ways are eternal. They're not changing. So what we have right here, we're beginning a tension between our temporal world that we live in. Like we can say, it's always been this way. We have, this is our culture. This is, but you see, that's always evolving. That's always changing. Even mountains are always there, but yet they're always eroding. They're always changing. There is a kingdom that is eternal, that cannot be shaken. And we're going to look at some verses about that here tonight. His ways are eternal. I saw the tents of Cushan in distress, the dwellings of Midian in anguish. Just two of Israel's enemies. When this begins to happen, if it be with God working through Babylon or Persia, or if it be His ultimately coming or Him moving Israel into their promised land, when these things take place, the nations realize we're losing a grip. Things are out of our control. And again, for us in our culture today, if indeed God is bringing judgment and is behind what we see taking place in our culture, I don't want to say there's nothing you can do about it, but if God is doing it, there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, we're supposed to pray, we're supposed to be involved, we're supposed to shine the light. So yes, there's things you can be doing, but if God is going from point A to point B in our culture, there's nothing you can do except get on board with God. Just like Joshua asked the angel of the Lord outside Jericho, when he approached him, he drew his sword, "Are you for us or for the enemy?" And the angel says, "Neither." It's like when we ask God, "Are you a Republican or a conservative or a Democrat or a leftist? What are you?" Neither. Just like Isaiah, we've used this verse many times. What do not call conspiracy everything these people call conspiracy. It is the Lord you are to fear. Are you for us or for Jericho? Neither. But as commander of the Lord's host, I've come to you. You're working for me. So it isn't God is on Israel's side. It's God has chosen Israel to be His servant. Now, right here in the book of Habakkuk, Israel has decided not to serve the Lord. Well, Israel's getting judged, or Jerusalem's going to be judged. So it wasn't like, why was God for Israel? He never was for Israel. He had chosen Israel to serve Him. He's chosen Israel to be His vessel. Now, if they choose to go back to the world, well, God's not going to, well, I got to stick with Israel. No, they need to stick with Him. The same thing in our culture. If America is going away, there's a good chance God is actively going to bring judgment. So what are you going to do? Well, you better decide whose side. Are you on the Republicans or the Democrats, or are you on the Holy One side? And Isaiah was told, don't call conspiracy everything these people call a conspiracy. It is the Lord you are to fear. And so right here, verse 7, I saw the tents of Cushan in distress, the dwellings of Midian in anguish. Whenever God begins to intervene, the nations are going to start losing a grip. And I think we are losing a grip on our society, even those, if there's a mastermind behind some, I mean, it's either incompetence on many levels, or it's a planned strategic deconstruction. And the scary thing about it is they think they're deconstructing something for a better utopia, but God is using them to fulfill His purpose, and they're going to lose a grip. Just like Babylon thought they were building a utopia, pretty soon it started slipping away. Here comes Persia. Persia had it began to slip away. Judas had a great plan, and then it slipped away. It's like, Judas stepped in, I'm going to fix this, and God let Judas do what Judas did. And then all of a sudden Judas is like, what? And it wasn't anything he expected. And I anticipate if our government is incompetent, we are in trouble. But if our government behind the scenes is being manipulated and there is something that is deconstructing, they may be the masters of the universe, they may be the masterminds, but they are tools of Yahweh doing His purpose. And when the time is right, they're going to feel just like Belshazzar at his party, just like Judas after he realized what he had done. The masters of our universe are going to realize, you know, I'm talking about whoever's behind the scene, you know, the deep state or whatever, if it even exists, they're not going to have what they think. It's not going to work out the way they think it will. Which is what we saw last night with the woman on the beast. Is the woman's riding the beast in Revelation 17, but she thinks she's the queen of running this whole operation, but actually it's the beast that's going to turn and destroy her and she's not going to have what she thought she had. Nonetheless, we continue now. So the nations will be fearful. In verse 8 through 15 now, I'm going to read in the NIV, then we're going to look at the English Standard on the notes. Verse 8, it continues. Were you angry with the rivers, O Lord? And there it is, Yahweh. Was your wrath against the streams? Did you rage against the sea when you rode with your horses and your victorious chariots? Were you angry with the water? You uncovered your bow and called for many arrows. And then Selah. That's whatever that means. That means stop and reflect on what he's saying. You split the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and writhed. Torrents of water swept by, the deep roared and lifted its waves on high. Notice how much is being done there with water. Water's responding to him. Captures two ideas. One, in the beginning, in creation, the earth was covered with water. In the biblical account and also in the pagan accounts of creation myths, there was always this ancient waters and monsters that were conquered by whoever was doing the organizing. Very similar to Genesis, although Genesis would be what we would say the authentic account. Verse 11, look at this. Sun and moon stood still in the heavens at the glint of your flying arrows, at the lightning of your flashing spear. So again, now you're going to have the sun and moon and stars responding to his presence in the atmosphere. So you got waters, you've got the sky, the lights. In wrath, you strode through the earth. Now he's clearly on the earth. You strode through the earth, and in anger you threshed the nations. That's why you saw in verse 7, Cushan and Midian were very concerned. You came out to deliver your people. There's the salvation, the day of the Lord. He's coming out in the day of the Lord. He's going to be bringing wrath to his enemies, but salvation to his people. And this is what Habakkuk wanted in 606. He was hoping you're going to bring deliverance. No, I'm going to destroy Jerusalem, and there'll be a time where I'll bring you deliverance, but this is not the day of deliverance in 605 and 586 B.C. You came out to deliver your people, to save your anointed one. You crushed the leader of the land of wickedness. You stripped him from head to foot. Selah. So there is the enemy being defeated. If it's Satan, how about in the Revelation? The beast and the false prophet were captured. And so there's the enemies being, the leaders are being captured. With his own spear, you pierced his head. So you captured him, and you didn't even use your weapons. You used his own weapons to destroy him. The enemy, the leader of the enemy, his own weapons destroyed him. Similar to the beast turning on the woman, or the Antichrist being defeated by the Lord, his own plan is going to fall in on him. With his own spear, you pierced his head when his warriors stormed out to scatter us, gloating as though about to devour the wretched who were in hiding. You trampled the sea with your horses, churning the great waters. Now in Revelation, the great waters refer to nations, people, languages, tribes, all the people. I don't want to shove that in here, but again, waters in Revelation refers to the nations. We've already mentioned the nations, though. You trampled the sea with your horses, churning the great waters. And you think of Daniel, where the waters were churned up, and here comes the beast out of the sea. I heard, and my heart pounded, and my lips quivered at the sound. Decay crept into my bones, and my legs trembled. Yet I will wait patiently for the day of calamity to come on the nation invading us. So that was the description. Now we're going to look at Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 8 through 15 on the notes. And first thing I want to point out is Habakkuk is talking with the Lord at his coming. And you may have noticed this, you may not have, going into verse 8. In chapter 3, verses 3 through 7, it's describing the Lord's appearing on Mount Paran, appearing in Teman. The heavens were filled with his glory, and then his praise filled the earth. Flashes are coming out of his hand. It's the Lord appearing, and Habakkuk is seeing this. Well, then in verse 8, what is interesting, he begins to talk with the Lord. Now, you can just go poetry if you want to. That's just a poetic expression. But you're going to have, between verse 8 and 15, the Lord is being spoken to by Habakkuk. Look in verse 8, for example. You're going to hear first, third person. You're going to hear it three times. Were you angry with the rivers, O Lord? Was your wrath against the streams? Did you rage against the sea? And I think you can see it better in the NIV on page 1, where in the notes, where I've got it underlined, the third person. Was your wrath against the rivers, O Lord? Was your anger against the rivers? Or your indignation against the sea? And then in the same line, when you rode on your horses on your chariot of salvation. Chapter 3, verse 9 on the notes. You stripped the sheep from your bow, calling for many arrows. You split the earth with rivers. You now have Habakkuk addressing God, asking Him questions. And that's the first thing you notice right there, which reminds me of Isaiah 63, verse 1. I'm going to flip over there. Which is another account of the Lord coming from Edom. And we've looked at it before. I'm sure we looked at it here a couple weeks ago. Chapter 63, verse 1 of Isaiah. Who is this coming from Edom, from Bozrah, with his garments stained crimson? And again, we go back to Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 3. God came from Teman. Well, that's the same basic place as Bozrah. It's not the same city, but it's the same. It's Edom. It's coming south from Edom. And so this is Isaiah 63. Who is this coming from Edom, from Bozrah? It's exactly what took place at Sinai. It's exactly what's being referred to in Habakkuk. With his garments stained crimson. So his garments are stained. Then it says, who is this robed in splendor, striding forward in greatness of his strength? The answer, it is I, speaking in righteousness, mighty to save. So there you've got the Lord appearing, and Isaiah is asking, you can see he's asking the Lord, who are you? Who is this? And he answers, it is I. It's the Lord. I'm the one you're looking at. And so he's seeing it. So you've got a dialogue between Isaiah and Yahweh. You've got Yahweh appearing in history and coming up from Edom. And it's so similar, I think, to chapter 3, where you've got him coming from Edom, coming from Teman. And then beginning in verse 8, he begins to ask him questions. I mean, you just came down and all these things happened. What, are you angry with the water? What is going on? And he begins to talk with him. So that's the first thing to notice right there, I think. The second thing I want to point out is I'm going to go to Hebrews chapter 12. And I think this captures the essence of what's going on here. We're talking about Hebrews chapter 12. We're talking about a time in history. And again, this is that part of Bible study that is useful. I mean, it's all useful, but this helps you get that perspective. When you go through life, when you read the news, when you have situations, when you see things that look like they're out of control, if this is the reason we are Christians, this is the reason we have a divine viewpoint. You have the world, we'll just say temporal. The temporal world we live in, and then you're going to have, I don't know how to draw heaven, there's the throne, then you've got eternal. Now, the eternal God, who is outside of time, created time, created matter, created the universe, created everything in the universe, including us and our souls, everything we have, from our souls to time to the physical universe, He created this. This is temporal. God is outside of it. We're talking about the immanent or the transcendent God. Immanent in the sense that He's beyond it. Transcendent means He can enter anytime He wants to. Eternal or immanent, outside of time, is where God exists. That's why it is a ridiculous question. Everything comes from somewhere. Where did God come from? Now, at first, that seems like, wow. And I asked my grandpa that question back. I was probably 6, 7 years old. I asked my grandpa out on the farm, who created God? Now, right here, that's a powerful question. Like, wow, what a smart little boy. It's like, except that's not a question. Because God created time. God created matter. Everything here is created by God. who is not limited in time because he created time. He's not limited to matter because he created matter. He's outside. It's like, what? Right, we don't live there. You have to understand it. Philosophically, it's a solid argument. I mean, it's like, well, that's what Christians believe. No, philosophically, you eventually get to that point. Everything has to come from somewhere. But the Greeks even came up. There eventually has to be, you get to a place where there had to be the original creating. You could have, well, this came from this, this came from this. And that's why I say, well, where did God come from? Well, God is the one who created everything you're talking about, which means God is outside and you can't touch him. He can't be changed. He is the eternal one. When they say he's the eternal one, that don't mean he's old. It means he's outside. He's eternal. He's outside. This whole thing can blow up, disappear. He's still there. He has not been touched. You can't change him. And so this is the temporal world. This is the eternal world. When he enters into this temporal world, we'd say a transcendent. He enters in. That's what God can do. A deist. We are theists. As a theist, our God is immanent but can transcend the universe. He can come into it. A deist can't. They got to stay outside, for example. When he comes in, you're going to have this affecting the waters, the mountains. Things are taking place. He's shaking. That is the natural response, is just a shaking is taking place here. We are looking forward. Habakkuk is looking for the day that this eternal comes into the temporal, and this is stabilized with an eternal presence of God here. We are in a shaky, changing world that appears to be out of control, except for the fact the eternal one is on the throne, directing this, bringing mercy during the time of wrath to lead this whole thing to a point of salvation, which is in Christ, which is under God, eternal. And so we have Hebrews chapter 12. I'm going to begin in verse 18 without reading the whole context here. The writer of Hebrews is trying to explain this to his people that are reading. They're in the temporal world. They've gone to Moses and the law and the temple worship, which is all temporal representation of the eternal. The eternal came to this called Jesus. He came and then returned to the throne. We saw the Son. They need to get in line with this Son, but they're impressed with the temporal, the rituals, the worship in the Temple Mount, the high priest of the line of Aaron. And we talk about that on Sunday mornings. So, this whole book has been about, don't put your hope in the temporal. Look at Jesus. He is the ultimate expression of humanity, and he'll take man to the fullness of his potential. Here it is. So he says right here in chapter 12, verse 18, "You have not come to a mountain that can be touched," and he's referring to Mount Sinai, "and that is burning with fire." And he's talking about Mount Sinai. He's talking about Mount Sinai and Moses. "To darkness, gloom, and a storm." That was the effect of Mount Sinai. When the Lord descended, there was darkness and there was gloom and they were scared. There was a storm. There was lightning. There was trumpet blast. Well, verse 19. "To a trumpet blast," or to such a voice speaking words. Now watch this. Speaking words. "They heard the voice of Yahweh on Mount Sinai." You go back and read it. "And when they did, they were terrified. They begged Moses that," well, look right here. So God is speaking. God came down on Mount Sinai. And the effect was there. The smoke, the gloom, the thunder, the lightning, the trumpet blast. And then he began to speak, "or to such a voice speaking words, that those who heard it begged that no further word," or the word in the Greek is rhema, not logos, but rhema, the spoken uttered word, an utterance. Logos means the rational expression. Logos became flesh. The logos, the rational expression of God, what God is, became flesh. That's John chapter 1. This is not logos, the rational expression. This is rhema, meaning the utterance. it'd be like the Logos came and then began to speak. It's like, one thing, you talk about the Logos, but now the Logos is actually making a presentation. It's like, oh my gosh, it's like looking at truth unfiltered. But here, they hear God speaking, or Yahweh, the second member of the Trinity, because it's not God the Father. No one's seen God the Father. It's the second member of the Trinity that's speaking on Mount Sinai, the one who became Jesus. Or to such a voice speaking words that those who heard it begged that no further word be spoken to them, because they could not bear what was commanded. And here, for example, to give you, he just chooses an example. If even an animal touches the mountain, it must be stoned. Meaning when God comes in, you can't even get closer. If an animal bumps the mountain, kill the animal. No, he says, that's terrifying. But that's temporal. You're scared of a temporal mountain because God has come down. So he says, and even animal, okay, the sight was so terrible. Watch this, verse 21. And this is something people miss sometimes. The sight was so terrifying that Moses said, I am trembling with fear. You know, Moses marched right up there to meet with God. No, he went on. Everybody's going to go meet with God. The original was everyone's going to go out and meet with God. And they got there. It's like, Moses, they start to talk to us. You go up there. And Moses being like the mediator, it's like, yeah, I don't think so. Let's just go back to Egypt. But Moses, out of responsibility, trembling, went up the mountain to meet with Yahweh. He says in verse 18 again, you have not come to this mountain. This is not the mountain Christians have come to. But you have come to Mount Zion. Now here, Mount Zion would have to refer to, well, here it says, to the heavenly Jerusalem. The city of the living God. Now, keep in mind, last night we talked about the woman on the beast, and the woman was Babylon, the city of Babylon, whichever city that's going to be historically when that occurs. It was a city that was evil. It was a godless... the cities of man are godless cities. They're running from God, trying to find the glory of man without God. This, though, is the heavenly city, the city of God. This is the city where man will reach his ultimate potential, because he will be with the Christ. He will be with his Creator and reach his maximum potential. If man wants glory, it's not in the cities of man, it's in the city of God. But you have come to Mount Zion, to the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God. You have come to thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly, to the church of the firstborn, whose names have been written in heaven. You have come to God, the judge of all men, to the spirits of righteous men made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant. This is the whole point of the book. To Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. See to it that you do not refuse him who speaks. If they did not escape when they refused him who warned them on earth, how much less will we if we turn away from him who warns us from heaven? At that time, watch this, here's the verse I'm looking for. At that time, on Mount Sinai, when he spoke on Mount Sinai, at that time his voice shook the earth. Now I want to remind you, that is what happens when a theophany occurs. That is what Habakkuk is talking about. When God comes from Edom, when God comes from Teman, when God comes from Sinai, there's bolts of flashing lights. There's the rivers are fleeing away, the mountains are quaking, because things are being shaken by his voice. At that time his voice shook the earth. Talk about Mount Sinai. But now he has promised, and here's a quote, he has promised, once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heavens. So this was when he came and shook this. But the writer of Hebrews is saying, in 63 AD, there's one more time God is coming to shake the earth. And that is indeed the day Habakkuk is looking forward to. It speaks of the end. I think that whole chapter 3 is talking about that day when he comes that one more time to shake the earth. at that time, okay, I'm looking here, and that's quoted, he's quoting that out of the book of Haggai. We haven't got to that minor prophet yet. The words once more, the writer of Hebrews says, the words once more indicate the removing of what can be shaken. When God comes, He's going to shake things that cannot stand, and He's going to replace them with things eternal. Once more indicates the removing of what can be shaken, that is, created things, so that what cannot be shaken will remain. Therefore, to the Christian, to Habakkuk, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful and so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. He is coming here, just like Habakkuk's describing. That's not those verses that we read in Habakkuk about, you know, the shaking and the lightning and the fire and the consuming. It's like, oh, that's the Old Testament God. No, it's an Old Testament passage talking about the second coming of Jesus Christ. And even the writer of Hebrews says, we have a consuming God. When He comes back, He's going to shake this temporal world. Everything's going to be removed. It's going to be burned up, and He's going to replace it with His own kingdom. And we're looking for something eternal. So let's go back to it. That's, I think, captures the essence of what is being said here in the book of Habakkuk chapter 3. Going back to chapter 3, on the notes, we already pointed this out. It says right there, Habakkuk 3, verse 8, was your wrath against the rivers, O Lord? Was your anger against the rivers, or your indignation against the sea? Notice again the waters being affected. And then he starts talking to them. When you rode on your horses, on your chariot of salvation. And again, point one right there, talk about the difference between your and you, from the third to second person. And he continues talking to the Lord. He is talking to the Lord, asking Him questions in chapter 3, verse 8, all the way up until chapter 3, verse 15. At which time he says, I heard and my heart quivered. In other words, the Lord is giving him a response, and he's like terrified of what he's going to have to live through. He's going to, in the future, see this deliverance, but in his own lifetime, he's going to see the destruction of Jerusalem. Pointing out here on the notes again, point three, rivers were territorial borders, and they indicate the reordering of the Lord's land, just like we see the nations trembling. When the rivers start moving, He's rearranging things potentially. Point four on the notes, when He came, the Lord struck the Red Sea. He struck the Jordan River. We can go read again about Barak and Deborah's battle against the Canaanites. The Kishon River running through the south part of the Megiddo Valley. It's a little river, but it rained so hard that the Kishon River just flooded and made the whole land muddy, and all the chariots of the Canaanites were useless, which led to the defeat of the Canaanite king. We don't need to go there and look at this, I don't think, because we talk about this on Monday nights. The waters are struck in Revelation with the trumpets. Remember the trumpets? Was it the second and third trumpets strike the water? The sea, and then the fresh water is struck with the trumpets being sounded. And if my eschatology model is correct, that is where, well, in fact, we're going to go look at it. We've done it before, but it's coming up to the very next point. Go to Revelation. Where did I write it down? Well, it's in Revelation 6. I don't see it written there. Go to Revelation 6. I don't want to bore you with reading a bunch of references, but sometimes it's pretty cool. Oh yeah, I think I made a mistake there in 16:12. It's Revelation 6:12. It's the sixth seal. So you got the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls. What we're looking at here is the seals, the scrolls being opened. And you know that sixth seal, I would think before the wrath begins, in fact, it is the beginning of the wrath. Chapter 6, verse 12, I watched as he opened the sixth seal. There was a great earthquake. And whenever you hear great earthquake, I think right now with what we've studied, you should think, uh-oh, if it says great earthquake, that must mean there is a theophany occurring. Meaning God is doing this. And I think it's a fair statement to at least put it there as a side note. Whenever you see, and there was an earthquake, there was a great earthquake, there were several earthquakes, it's like, oh, I wonder why that's happening. Maybe God's bringing judgment. Maybe, just like all of the other appearances of the Lord, whenever He appears in the temporal world, there's a shaking and earthquakes result. So when you see earthquake, you could almost say it's God entering into history. And that is exactly what you have with this sixth seal. There was a great earthquake. The sun turned black, just like Habakkuk's going to talk about. The sun, we're going to read these verses again. The lights are going to be affected here with this seal, but also with the trumpets and the bowls. The sun turned black with like sackcloth made of goat hair. The whole moon turned blood red, and the stars in the sky fell to the earth as late figs drop from a fig tree when shaken by a strong wind. The sky receded like a scroll rolling up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. What you have there is, remember how it talks about the light flashing from His hands and the power that it conceals? This is the Lord appearing in the atmosphere right here. And it doesn't say the sun disappeared and the moon disappears. It says they became dark. It's like there's something brighter. It's that radiating light of the Lord appearing here with the sixth seal. And a theophany is manifested in the universe. So you're going to have earthquakes. You're going to have the mountains and islands being removed from the place. And the sky, it appears to just roll up. It's gone. You can't see the sky anymore because there's this brightness there. Like when you go outside, it's just like, ah, where's the sky? It must have rolled up. The stars must have fell. Everything's gone. You can see a little bit of the moon, a little bit of the sun from behind the glory of the Lord that's in the atmosphere. Now watch. Is this true? Is that really what happened? Do people see this? Verse 15. Then the kings of the earth, the princes and the generals, the rich and the mighty, and every slave and every free man hid in caves and among the rocks of the mountains. They called to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of Him who sits on the throne. In other words, indeed, there has been. They can see the face of the One seated on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. In other words, they can see the Lord and they know He's come to pour out wrath on their nations. Just like in Habakkuk, He says, Cushan and Midian trembled. It's like, there He is. And they're trembling. They're no... Borders are about to be moved. Things are about to be shaken and changed. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand? And that is, the Lord is in the air. Now, the other things that take place from that place right there, well, right there in verse 8, or chapter 8 is the very next chapter in your, oh, you got two chapters. Chapter 8, verses 8 through 11. From this throne, the trumpets will be sounded. And in chapter 8, verse 8, the second angel sounded his trumpet, and something like a huge mountain all ablaze was thrown into the sea. A third of the sea turned to blood. A third of the living creatures died. Ships were destroyed. Verse 10, the third angel sounded his trumpet, and a great star blazing like a torch fell from the sky. And a third of the rivers and the springs of water. The name of the star was Wormwood. The third of the waters turned bitter, and many people died. And the waters had become, because the waters became bitter. The mountains have disappeared. The islands have disappeared. The water's being struck. Things are happening on the earth because of this theophany in Revelation, which I think can be tied right back into what Habakkuk is looking forward to, because the vision says awaits, or it occurs at the end. The vision awaits at the appointed time at the end. Go back to Habakkuk, please. Well, you've got it on the notes there. Also, you can see the Euphrates is going to be dried up also with one of the bowls. Point six, Baal was said to ride on the chariots of the clouds of the storm. That was Baal, but it's actually Yahweh. So you begin to wonder how much of this pagan religion is picked up from the original Yahweh, and they morph their gods into these. Interestingly, it talks about him. It says, you rode on your horses and your chariot of salvation. Your chariot of salvation. Go to 1 Chronicles. I haven't done this for a while, but go to 1 Chronicles. And this is worth knowing. 1 Chronicles 28. And this, I don't want to take too long of a detour on this. And I can just sense this is going to be a detour. Because it mentions there his horses and his chariot of salvation. Now, I want you to remember what I just described in Revelation, the sixth seal. The throne of God is going to appear in the atmosphere, and the glory is going to be there. The signs of the Son of Man, like lightning, will be seen from east to west, and like vultures will be circling. That's his own words in Matthew. And it's going to be hovering. Okay? Now, you go back to, remember Jesus called the sign of the Son of Man, you go back to Ezekiel, and Ezekiel sees this throne, and it's got angels, cherubim, four cherubim, those are cherubim, there's one on each corner, make this three-dimensional if we could here, and they've got a wheel within a wheel, they've got four wings, and the wheels are connected to the wings, and in the middle is a man seated on the throne, and this is a scene, it comes in like a storm. It's like a chariot being carried around in the atmosphere. And there's one, two, three, four angels carrying it wherever the wheels go, or the wheel within a wheel that are connected to the wings of the angels. How you can read that whole thing. This, and he calls from this man who would be the Son of God or the Son of Man, calls to Ezekiel and calls him the Son of Man. Jesus says, you'll see the sign of the Son of Man in the heavens. So the Son of Man will be seated on it, just like Daniel says, the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven. But it's exactly what the Son of Man Ezekiel saw. Because the Son of Man is calling Ezekiel the Son of Man. I'm just saying, it's just not that they're the same person, but it's just interesting to go either way. Now, in the tabernacle, in the most holy place, here's the tabernacle, here's the court, here's the tabernacle. You've got the bronze altar here. You've got the bronze altar here. You've got the basin in here. Inside here, you've got the tent of meeting or the tabernacle itself. This is just the outer court. In here, you've got the lampstand, the table of showbread, and then you've got the altar of burnt incense right here. But sitting back here is the Ark of the Covenant. That is God's presence. In Ezekiel's day, when this had been converted into a temple, Ezekiel sees a vision of the glory of God that came and was seated in the temple and in the tabernacle on that Ark of the Covenant. He sees the glory of God get up and move to the front of the temple and then leaves the temple, leaving Jerusalem unprotected. He sees the glory of the God. He sees this fly out of the temple. Ezekiel sees that. Now this is the tabernacle. Now we're going to look at that Ark of the Covenant. The Ark of the Covenant was a box. That's a very poor picture of a box. But it had a lid. It was made out of gold, hammered by the craftsman out of one solid piece of gold. And coming up on it was two cherubim like this. Okay, forgive me as I draw. Those are two cherubim. Those are the wings. And they're looking at this spot right here, and this is where the priest, this is where the presence of the Lord, and these are the cherubim protecting the presence of the Lord. David is not wants, he wants to build the temple, but he's not allowed to. His son gets to build the temple, but David leaves behind the plans. And in what we're looking at right now, 1 Chronicles 28, we're looking at the plans that were given him. I'll begin in verse 16. I'll begin in verse 15 to give you a little boring information. Just kind of read up to it. Watch how you stumble past this and don't even know it's there. He's talking about all the furniture, the weight of gold for the gold lampstands and the lamps, with the weight of each lampstand and its lamps, and the weight of the silver for each silver lampstand and its lamps according to the use of each lampstand, the weight of the gold of each table for the consecrated bread, and the weight of the silver for the silver tables, the weight of the... Now notice right here in the tabernacle, they had one lampstand, they had one table of showbread, they had one altar of incense that they burned incense in front of the curtain. Solomon is going to have 12 lampstands, 12 tables, and he's going to have everything. He's going to have a big monumental cherubim sitting back by the mercy seat, or the Ark of the Covenant, the mercy seat. they're going to be elaborate. So this is all, when it says plural, they're talking about the multiple tables and multiple lampstands they're going to add to it. The weight of pure, verse 17, the weight of pure gold for the forks, sprinkling bowls and pitchers. A lot of these items are going to end up in Babylon with Nebuchadnezzar and then be used by his grandson at Belshazzar's feast. The weight of gold for each of the gold dishes, the weight of silver for each of the silver dishes, and the weight of the refined gold for the altar of incense that sits before the curtain. He also gave him the plan for the chariot. What? There's a chariot in the tabernacle or the temple? That is the cherubim of gold that spread their wings and shelter the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. So this, what we call mercy seat, is right there in your Bibles called the chariot that sits on the Ark of the Covenant. It was probably about this big, but it's a chariot. It is an image of, guess what? What flew out of the tabernacle temple when Ezekiel saw the chariot of God fly out with the cherubim, and he sees it in Babylon when the Lord calls Ezekiel, son of man, to save the people of Judah or Jerusalem or Israel. And then Jesus says the sign of the Son of Man will appear. This would be what we see. He refers to that in Matthew 24. And this is the sixth seal of what you see. It's the chariot and Habakkuk in the end of chapter 3, verse 8. And you rode on your horses on your chariot of salvation. Now, what is, he's coming in a theophany. He's appearing in the atmosphere on his chariot. Well, we have a description of this in Ezekiel. Jesus refers to it when he says when he comes back at the second coming, you're going to see the sign of the Son of Man. The sixth seal of Revelation describes it, and they see the one who sits on the throne and say, hide us from this. And it's all pictured right here, a chariot. There's the Lord, there's the cherubim on the throne. There's the throne right there. It's all right there. So what you see taking place right here in Habakkuk 3, it just sums it up. And this, you could call this right here, it's called the mercy seat, because that's where you go for mercy. They put the blood there once a year by the high priest because they need mercy. It's the place you go for salvation. It's the chariot of submit. When it appears, when the Lord appears, what's he bringing? Well, he's bringing, hide us from him who sits on the throne and from the, sorry, I spelled wrath wrong, the wrath of the Lamb. That's for the world. What are we looking at? If you read the next chapter in Revelation, it ends that chapter, chapter 6, it ends. And who can stand? And who can stand when this happens? And then it describes two groups that can stand. The 144,000 Jews that are sealed on earth, and those that are taken out of the great tribulation are brought up here, and they are standing before the throne of God. So when this appears, this chariot of the Lord, or the chariot of salvation appears, the world sees it as wrath. Very clearly, those in the great tribulation are taken up here. They see it as, so in fact, they start singing about salvation in the text. This is the chariot of salvation. This is the mercy seat. This is what's coming. And Habakkuk, I mean, I think he's talking about that very thing. I don't even think, I would say, I rest my case. Habakkuk is talking about this coming and the great theophany of the second coming, because the prophecy even says it speaks of the end. Well, we got to quit because we're running out of time. Any questions?
So the top of the Holy of Holies or whatever.
Top of the Ark of the Covenant.
The Ark is the same as the.
This would be a physical representation of the spiritual. Oh, and I should see this right here. See these, the cherubim carrying, flying it around in Ezekiel. When they carried this Ark of the Covenant. Here's the Ark of the Covenant right here. Not supposed to be like that. Here's the mercy seat. I'll do the cherubim again there. There's the mercy seat. There was rings right here, put in the foot, and they had long poles. Acacia wood covered with gold on this side. If I go three-dimensional here, and on this side, a long pole. And then you know what was underneath those right there? There'd be a priest. Here's his head. Here's his shoulder. And there's a priest carrying this one. A priest there's this gown, this arm right here, and a priest over here, and the city, 1, 2, 3, 4 priests, and they'd slide those, they'd remain there. When they'd pick it up, they'd pick it up on their shoulders, and they'd walk like this. That's how they walk into the Jordan River. They carried the Ark of the Covenant with the container. You had the law of the Ten Commandments, had the jar of manna, had the rod of Aaron that budded was inside there, and on top a solid piece of gold with a cherubim here and the presence of God, and these four priests looking just like the cherubim that you see in Ezekiel, carrying it all through the wilderness into the promised land and setting it down in the tabernacle. And this is why when we came to Beth Shemesh, from the Philistines, they put it on a cart, and all the people went and looked in it. They died, and when David got it, he put it on a cart and started carrying it into Jerusalem, and the cart rocked a little bit, one of the oxen stumbled, and one of the priests, one of the best priests, reaches up, stabilizes it, boom, dropped dead. And David goes, whoa, I don't understand this. Right, because you haven't paid attention in Sunday school, David. And he went back, and they read all this. They read all this, like, oh my gosh, where are those poles at? And they got the priests, and they did it like this, and they carried it right into Jerusalem. Because this is a type. I think that's a slam dunk. This is a picture of the chariot of God in Ezekiel. It's a picture of the sign of the Son of Man. David calls this the chariot of God. Habakkuk just called it the chariot of salvation. When it appears, you're going to have havoc. Mountains disappearing, earthquakes when it appears in the atmosphere. But it is bringing salvation. Okay, I'll quit. Any other questions? I'll pray if you have a question. Please feel free. Father, you thank again for the chance of looking through these things. We look forward to our ultimate day of salvation. We ask that we would be faithful to you in these times, at this time in history, during these temporal times of the shaking and the changing of the earth. Father, I do ask that we again would have confidence in you because of your word and be able to encourage others and live a life of faith before you. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your time.